ask you?
Good evening and welcome. My name is Natalie Turvey. I'm Executive Director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation. On behalf of the CJF, thank you for joining us for this JTalk event, No Safe Space, Harassment of Women in Media. I'd like to thank those who make our events possible: BMO Financial Group, our JTalk series sponsor, CNW, our in-kind supporter, and our thanks to CPAC, Canada's Public Affairs Channel, for its broadcast of tonight's event. The CJF was founded 27 years ago on the belief that quality journalism in our country leads to a thriving democracy. And we know our democracy is best served by a plurality of voices in our media. While the digital era has made for a more open and diverse news environment, it has also made for a more hostile one for women. Many journalists, and women in the media in particular, experience online hate for simply doing their jobs. They're targeted by individuals and groups seeking to silence their voices. In the lead up to International Women's Day, we're proud to be tackling this important topic. How can our newsrooms, our social media platforms, and men and women online help create safe digital spaces for women in media? To say a few words, I'd like to welcome someone to the stage who has devoted her career to shedding light on women's issues around the world. She's an award-winning journalist, activist, author, filmmaker. She's a former director of the CJF, and she also happens to be our moderator's mother-in-law. Please join me in welcoming to the stage our dear friend, Sally Armstrong.
You took away my thunder. I was going to act as though I didn't know her. Anyway, I'm Sally Armstrong. I'm the jury chair for the Landsberg Award, and we're thrilled to have two of the Landsberg Award winners with us on the panel tonight. In fact, we're pretty much thrilled with everything that's happened since the Landsberg Award was launched. It has attracted spectacular writing from across the country and radio and TV work from across the country. The award was created to celebrate a journalist who is raising awareness about women's equality issues in Canada and aims to inspire to increase media coverage of issues that are important to women, especially getting women's voices into the news. So tonight's panel gives us an opportunity to examine an issue women reporters are increasingly finding themselves caught in. I was just saying to my colleagues, I've just returned from Iraq on assignment, and I had to do a couple of stand-ups, and frankly, you know how people see a camera and start acting like idiots? And I was surprised nothing happened. Maybe it has to do with my age, but there was very little harassment this time. So to handle the topic we're dealing with tonight, which is harassment from readers and listeners and viewers to women, I want to introduce the moderator of the panel, Pia Chattopadhyay. Pia is the host of CBC Radio's Out in the Open. You've probably heard it. It's a fabulous show. It's an adventurous and wide-ranging weekly one-hour program about the nitty-gritty of real life. I sometimes worry you're going to talk about, you know, things we both know. Anyway, each week, Chattopadhyay and her team look at how one big topic is affecting regular people, and they invite listeners to join in the conversation. Prior to that, Pia worked, well, she worked everywhere. Everybody knows her. When I make a speech in Canada, all I have to do is mention Pia Chattopadhyay, and everybody starts to clap, because if she's not filling in on the current, she's doing the news at 6, or she's doing Q, and she was also filling in for Steve Paikin at The Agenda. Pia has reported from Sri Lanka, Afghanistan, India, the UK, France, just to name a few places. And in 2007, she decided to move to Jerusalem. Now, they say it's because it was her career. I think it was because she wanted to see my son, but that's a different story. She freelanced in Jerusalem for the CBC, for PRI, for BBC, but then she took on a job as a Middle East correspondent for Fox News Radio. And during her 3 years in the region, she traveled to numerous countries covering stories ranging from war and conflict, peace and politics, and everyday life. She is also, this is my favorite part, the mother of three adorable children, and she is indeed my daughter-in-law, Pia Chattopadhyay.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. This is not Family Promotion Hour, but I will just tell you a quick story. Back in 2003, I had moved at CBC from television to radio, and I was watching TVO one night, and I saw this fabulous interview with a woman named Sally Armstrong, who I knew something about, but not a lot about. And I went to work the next day, and one of my colleagues called me over and said, hey, look at this. And they had something on the screen. And I said, what's that? And they said, oh, look at this book cover. And I said, oh, yeah. And I said, oh, my gosh, last night she was on TVO. She was fabulous. She was fabulous. And my colleague looked at me like this, and I said, Armstrong, Armstrong, that's your mother? And as I like to say, one marriage and three children later, here we are. So thank you, TVO, and to Sally for doing that interview, because my life is happy because of that. I am thrilled and not thrilled to be here tonight. I am thrilled because we need to talk about what we're about to talk about. It's important, it's prescient, it's prevalent, and it is hard. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, I wish we weren't here having to talk about this at all. I wish we could just not be having to deal with this, and that this wasn't a real thing that's facing so many of us all the time. And on the third hand, which I have because I'm a Hindu goddess, I would just say if we just look around, and there are many of us here tonight, both women and men, and we represent so many others in the media, and I'm glad we have each other. I have learned over the years how important it is not only to have girlfriends, but women friends in the media, and I think now more than ever, we need those to help us find a way forward to deal with these kinds of issues. So yay, thank you for coming. Just a couple of things that I want to just kind of housekeeping things. We do have security here. That's deliberate, but I just wanted everyone to know that. We don't anticipate any problems or anything like that, but I just want to know if anyone, we want to make sure everyone feels safe and safe to talk about things. The second thing is camera at the back, camera over here. CPAC is recording this for broadcast, so just be aware of that, because we will have time for Q&A, and we want people to be frank and open, but I just also want you to know that this is being recorded. And the third thing is about social media. So if you want to tweet, and we encourage that, or use any other social media platform, that is absolutely fine. I just ask a few things. Anything set up here is public, and you can tweet that. I would ask when we get to the Q&A part with the audience that if the person speaking tweets something, you can retweet it, but I'd ask you not to do that just so people can feel okay, and if they want that stuff shared publicly, to let them be that voice first. Okay, good ground rules. Can I just ask the women in this audience, who here has been personally harassed on a platform of social media or in real life in the last 5 years? Okay, so take a look around. That's a great number of us that have had this. And so I really want tonight to be a conversation about our lived experiences, but also in some ways to navigate a way forward to try and come up with some solutions. I would argue that no one has a perfect solution right now, because or else we would all our organizations would be implementing that. But let's try and get some answers tonight. So let me introduce the panel. I think they're all familiar to you, but let me start at the corner there. That's Janet. Hi, Janet. Janet McFarland, who works for the Globe and Mail's Report on Business. She's been doing that for 11 years now, since 1995. And she...
You're good at math.
Yeah, I know, quick. Specialized in reporting on corporate governance and compensations and securities regulation. Janet's written extensively on issues of governance, leadership, women in business, and executive compensation. Janet graduated from the LSE, and she has also won many awards for her work, including two national newspaper awards. And as Sally mentioned, she was a recipient of the inaugural Landsberg Award in 2014. Janet, say hello.
Hello.
Hello. Okay. We can clap. It's good. It's good to clap. Manisha Krishnan is a senior writer at Vice Canada, and she reports on subjects such as vigilante pedophile hunting in the cannabis industry, systemic racism, sexual violence against women. She's also hosted a Vice documentary on Canadian gun culture. She's written for The Star before that, Maclean's, The Calgary Herald, and many other publications. Hi.
Hi.
And next to Manisha is Heather Malik, who is a staff columnist at The Star since 2010?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Heather writes about a lot of things. Women's rights, politics, nationalism, the way we live now. She, in a previous life before her star life, has written for the CBC digital platform, cbc.ca, the Globe and Mail, Chatelaine, the New York Times Syndication Service, Guardian's Comments is Free. Heather has won 2 national newspaper awards in the features and critical writing categories, and she was the winner of the Landsberg Award the year after Janet was in 2015. Hi, Heather. Okay, so I have a clock. We're just going to do this a bit organically. We're going to talk for a bit, but I want to leave a lot of time for questions and answers, and so we'll go a little bit back and forth. There is a microphone at the back, and I'll kind of ask if we have questions. Just put up your hand, and we'll kind of take it from there. But let me start just to open it all up. Tell me about your personal lived experience when we talk about women in the media and harassment.
Well, you know, I remember it starting, I think it was 2004, 2005, and I went on the Bill O'Reilly show on Fox, because in those days I thought, well, to be a decent person, perhaps you should talk to these very unfortunate people who watch that show. I felt sorry for them. And I thought, out of fairness, oh God, I'm so Canadian about it. Anyway, I went on the show, he told lies, he made up stuff, he made up the names of magazines. He was Bill O'Reilly. But in those days, you know, you thought, well, that's just funny. And then I started getting messages from people in Florida and Texas and so on. And I thought, who are these people? And I described them as a monkey on my back. And I don't know who the monkeys were. But that's how it began. And that's when things started to turn mean. Now, since then, well, as you know, it's just nonstop. And then I went on Twitter, I think, in 2011. And that turned horrible fairly quickly. I'm isolated now. I no longer tweet on Twitter. I just retweet. I don't answer my phone in the newsroom because it's the same guys yelling at me all the time and leaving messages. I absolutely will not open mail unless it's from a company I recognize sending me a book. And the reason for that is at least a couple of times the Conservative Party of Canada has sent out a message, an email to all its voters in Canada pointing out one of my columns and calling for money to be sent to them to fight people like me. So that's individually attacking journalists, and it is a very bad thing with very bad consequences. And that is the reason I no longer open my mail physically. I just chuck it out. So essentially, it's been pretty unpleasant, and it has isolated me as a journalist. So now I don't speak as much except in my columns. I just read, I take things in, but I communicate much less than I used to.
I'll come back to this, Heather, more with you in a moment, but as you said, you've isolated yourself, and yet you're in the communications business.
That's right.
So how has this affected your ability to do your work to the best of your ability?
I don't think it's harmed it. I think it has harmed me personally. I'm still able to read everything. I'm in contact with everything that's happening. But I communicate with readers all the time, but I have blocked out a lot of the readers who have sent me death threats or various other threats. I'm much more careful around my home. I'm glad we have security guards at the office. And one thing I think we should talk about, I do worry about younger journalists who work in places where there aren't security guards, journalists who are independent. You don't have the kind of physical protections that I have, and lawyers to protect you, and layers of people. And I worry about them more than people who work in mainstream journalism.
Manisha, what's been your experience?
Yeah, so before I started working at Vice, I was at The Star and a bunch of other news outlets, and I was basically doing straight news all the time. But after I came to Vice, I started doing both news and more columns, so more opinion pieces. So last year, covering the Gomeshi trial, for sure there was people who don't believe in the idea of rape culture and stuff like that, who would sometimes troll me on Twitter. But I feel like it really sort of blew up once I started writing more opinion-type pieces about racism. And so things were tense with Black Lives Matter and Pride last summer. And so I'd written a few pieces around that. And that's when the harassment sort of really ramped up. And, you know, like my mentions in Twitter just for days on end would just be, it would just be like the most heinous slurs that you can sort of imagine. That's when it started creeping into my email. The relentlessness of it sort of took me by surprise. Because of that, I think that I made myself a bit of a target in a sense. Like, people knew at this point that I was writing about race. And so, you know, I've had sort of creepy things. There's like a 20-minute YouTube video of this guy who is just reading my columns out loud in like a black Southern accent and like sort of just mimicking me for 20 minutes. Like, it was about me and I couldn't even finish it because it was just so boring. I'm like, get a life, bro, you know? But yeah, it's like, for some people, I feel like it becomes this fixation and they get like a little bit, you feel like they're a little bit obsessed with you and your work, and they'll kind of come back to you so you know that they remembered you. Since then, I've had other sort of experiences. When I wrote about the vigilante pedophile hunting, that's one of the stories I wrote was from the point of view of a pedophile who had never offended. And so that got picked up by the alt-right and by the Daily Stormer. It's like an alt-right neo-Nazi website that's big in the US. And so at that point, you know, there were like memes of me being hanged, like just really, really ugly, ugly stuff. I've had like a fake Facebook profile of me where someone actually had a conversation with themselves, but like acting as me and saying things like that I'm a transvestite and stuff like that. So yeah, it's just sort of like gradually like ramped up more and more. Yeah.
And you talk about it so matter-of-factly.
Yeah.
Like this happened and then this happened. But it has to take a toll. So,
yeah, it probably does. But I think that's maybe partially my personality. Like, I tend to downplay things a lot. Like, I actually had a voicemail once that was just somebody whispering, "You're gonna die, bitch." And I actually told a couple of my coworkers, and they were the ones who were really pushing me to tell HR and to report it to the police. But that's just not somewhere. I mean, I think I'm getting a little bit better now, but that's just not somewhere that I would immediately go. Like, I'm really the type of person to brush things off. So as far as like how it's actually affected me, I think, you know, I probably should talk about it with a therapist or something, because I still don't know.
Okay, we'll get more into that in a moment. Janet, what's your experience has been like?
Well, these stories are heartbreaking. I mean, I'm sitting here feeling just horrible for both of you. I don't write a column, and that insulates me a lot from this sort of abuse, because my husband writes a business column and he gets terrible abuse. I mean, I think one thing to say is that journalists in general, both genders, get a lot of critical feedback. And I think there's a subset of feedback that's very gendered, but I think you don't want to sort of forget the fact that I've read aloud to me from a lot of really awful emails about how, you know, you're a stupid, ignorant moron kind of emails to my husband too. So it's not like women only get this. I think there's a subset of gendered, I made that word up, but gendered criticism that's definitely aimed at the fact that you're a woman. And I certainly haven't had anything like these. I would call these criminal levels of harassment. For me, the negative comments that I get that I would call are more directed to me personally as a woman. And, you know, people call me maybe I shouldn't say the words, but, you know, the B word and the C word and stuff like that. Those are exclusively when I write about women's issues. I've written for decades as a journalist and I haven't gotten one, lots of rude comments and one abusive comment. About anything to do with anything except when I write about why there aren't more women in leadership, why there aren't more women on boards, why there's a gender pay gap and inequality, those kinds of issues. Suddenly, that is just the issue in my world anyway that brings out the the crazy people who just see that as an immediate attack upon them and that they have to fight back to save their lives. I mean, they're fighting with clenched fists. But in my case, again, this is for me, it's Twitter comments or an email or something that I personally, you know, I don't put it on par with this kind of experience. And it's much easier to ignore. Just erase them, kill them. I've blocked a couple people over the years, but not that many, because, you know, I don't mind criticism as long as it's not profane.
You know, it's interesting to hear you three speak about it because, well, at least Manisha and Janet, you both kind of downplay your experiences. Like, you know, people are critical, or my coping mechanism is to kind of brush it off. And I wonder, I'd like to get your perspectives on this, how much do you think that is to our detriment, that we're just kind of, on some level, accepting this as part of women working in the media business?
Yeah, if somebody left me a voicemail whispering that I was going to die, bitch, I would not downplay that. I think I can legitimately downplay what I've experienced compared to your experience.
Yeah, I think, I don't know. Well, I think that this is just a tough industry in general. It really takes a lot to even sort of make it in this industry. So I think just over time, generally speaking, as a reporter, like, you develop really thick skin, and you also learn to keep your head down and just do your work and not really complain, not complain to your editors. So I think that it's taken, like, at Vice, I've actually gotten quite a bit of support from editors, and editors coming to me and saying, like, hey, can I take you out for coffee? Can I take you out for lunch? Yeah, I know, it does happen. And just being like, are you okay? And yeah, that sounds like a really basic human thing, but there's a lot of newsrooms that don't even offer that support, especially to younger employees. So I think, like, having other people show that type of concern, it's actually made me realize, yeah, this is actually really shitty, and this is a thing that, you know, I shouldn't actually have to deal with this as part of my job. So I think that's been a bit of a learning process for me.
Heather, you gave Manisha a
physical look. Well, the idea of an editor taking you out for coffee and saying, are you okay? That has never happened to me. I'm getting a bit tearful here. Can I come work for you? That just sounds lovely. No, I think there's, in mainstream newsrooms, they're run on manly terms. They're run on 1950s style male things. Hey, you better show how tough you are. You know, and everything's funny. And so I learned to do that in my own way. I call it covering pain with jokes. But when I'm talking to an audience like you, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to tell you the truth of what it's like. I believe in complete candor at these events. And I'm going to tell you that it's just awful. It's just depressing and horrible. You are surrounded by people who take a dark view of life. And I often call them sweepy faces. Now, sweepy face was a troll in Britain who had been tormenting the parents of a little girl who had been kidnapped and possibly murdered on holiday in Portugal. She was never found. The McCann case, Madeleine McCann. And she had been tormenting the parents of this child for years and years. And there was a whole, almost a club of people in Britain doing this. And this woman's name on Twitter was Sweepy Face. And she was uncovered, and it was not pleasant. But I call them sweepy faces. These trolls are very nasty people. I don't think they're funny anymore, and it's absolutely not typical of me to say something's unfunny, but these trolls are not funny. They're scary.
Can we talk a little bit about culture? And you don't have to talk specifically about the place that you currently work, but the culture of media organizations, both big and small. And Heather, you just spoke a little bit about that, but about what the culture is like when we say, this has happened to me, or I want to talk about this, or is there a silencing around the culture? Janet, what's your experience been like in terms of newsroom culture?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we all know newsroom culture is definitely not warm and fuzzy and hand-holding at all, and no one is ever rewarded or encouraged to complain. Nobody cares about your problems. That's a really sweeping statement. That's really not fair to make, but I mean, that's to overgeneralize. I think that Heather's comment was absolutely bang on about young journalists, because as you get older, you've either left or you're able to, you have better, you know, coping mechanism for it. You're a thick-skinned person, or you just, I don't think I'm thick-skinned at all, and I'm not cynical at all, but I think I'm much more able to put it in perspective and say, oh, I don't even remember what the, I killed an email and a week later I couldn't have even told you what it said because it was like so unimportant to me, it's not relevant. But I think it really affects young people. I was talking about this panel with one of my colleagues who's been at the Globe now for 5 years and is a wonderful young reporter, and we were discussing this and she said, you know, my very first thing I ever wrote when I first got hired, I was so excited and I went to read the reader comments thinking that people would, like, wonder if people are as excited about this issue as I was, and they were so negative, and one of them was because she was a young woman and somebody had written this horrible one of the replies, and she just said it completely like took her legs out from underneath her. She was so demoralized that somebody would say something so awful, and I really thought, oh my gosh, it's been so long. It's hard for me to put myself back in that situation, but certainly if I were in any kind of, in fact, I was gonna say if I were in any position of authority, but I actually think that it doesn't even, even as a fellow coworker, I'm gonna try to be a lot more aware of talking to young women about this and making sure they're okay, because it really is a lot harder to take this when you're not.
Can I interject one small thing? Because you talked about thick skin. I know nobody's going to agree with me here. I think if you're going to be a good writer, you should not develop a thick skin. If you want a thick skin, go into real estate sales where, things are cut and dried and you either make the sale or you don't. But in a more complicated job, a thick skin is not your friend. You have to find strength elsewhere. I don't think you can be a good writer.
What
if you have rhino hide?
What do you mean by that? Like, can you explain what you mean by thick skin?
I think if you become
too cynical,
something, yeah, you become cynical and hard-hearted, and to be a good writer, you have to be, and I think it was Henry James that said this, be the person upon whom nothing is lost. You have to notice a million little details. If you have rhino hide, you're looking at things more generally and you're not noticing the details. So it can really affect your writing that way and make you into a boring writer. So a thick skin is not, who wants to read something written by a rhino? I don't want rhino hide. I want to be the person I always was. And so you have to maybe have a distinct separation between your work life and your private life. And of course, with Trump, tweeting in the morning, that's the first tweet I get when I wake up, then that's not going to happen. You can't have that separation in life. Crazy has overtaken your life. And you don't want to turn into
maybe that. Thick skin isn't the perfect term, but I think we all have to find ways to take the blows. Because or else it will destroy us either professionally or personally or worse, both.
Yes.
So I think, Manisha, what is the culture that you have observed in your various work experiences in terms of dealing with these issues?
I think that I definitely agree with what these two ladies said about how newsrooms can be really sort of cold and unfeeling places. But I think things have changed a lot. So, a lot of this hatred now is based, like, it's on the internet, it's online. So I would just say that, working at Vice, obviously, we're online and that's the audience that we're targeting. And also because of the type of stories that I do now, where I'm talking sometimes about race or gender, more controversial issues, and sometimes inserting my opinion, I'm getting a lot more hatred now than I did at some of the previous places that I worked. Having said that, as I've said, my editors here have shown, definitely the most support to me than in any of the, I've worked in a lot of different newsrooms. So by far, I would say that. But I would just say, if there's any editors here that sort of work at some of those more traditional, larger newsrooms, it's something to be cognizant about if you're hiring interns or really young reporters. They're trying so hard just to impress you, and they're not going to come to you and let you know that something's wrong. So if you're asking them to write about these issues that are going to inflame discussion and potentially make them a target, it's kind of on you to check in with them and see how they're doing, because they're not going to want to be that person that's, whiny.
Let's talk about sort of our own personal policies about, and especially when it comes to online, do you engage? Do you enrage? Do you ignore? Because I think we all have kind of different ways of going about it. So Heather, you said you're off Twitter, you'll read.
Jim Rankin, who's one of the best reporters at The Star, told me early on, do not engage, do not engage. That's how he said it, and he's absolutely right. Even though you feel drawn to it and they're trying to get you to do that, just stay out of it. You can't get inside this person's head. And you would, it's a nasty place, you wouldn't want to be there anyway.
So you don't engage at all? Do you read the comments about you? I don't
read the comments. And the Star has gotten rid of comments, but the CBC has them. I do not know why. The Globe still has them, and you'd think that they'd be higher quality comments.
Oh,
you'd like
awful.
To think of that. And I look at the Globe comments, and I go, I had no idea these people were reading ROB. They're savages.
I don't know, just because I was coming to this tonight, I wrote a story today in today's paper that could not have been, it was a story about how there was a poll or a survey done by the Chinese website Jiuai about how many potential Chinese buyers are looking at various Canadian cities and how that shifted away from Vancouver. How uncontroversial would that seem? And there were 60-something comments on my story, and for some reason I never read the comments, never, and I read them today. And they were so racist. It was just, again, they weren't sexist, so at least there was that. But and I thought, they were so awful, horribly racist series of things. And I thought, oh, just once again, why did I even look at these comments? And there, a number of years ago, the Globe actually sent out a thing encouraging us to go into the comments
and join them and
respond to the people, and so that we can build a sense of community by having a conversation. And I think with these readers, and I don't know if any Globe reporters actually tried to do that, but I think the vast majority of us were like, no, thank you, no, we won't do that. And I don't reply to any abusive emails or anything. I just, again, maybe that's chicken-hearted, but when I said thick skin, I think maybe what I was trying to express was that you've got to find a way to do your job and cope. And you can't do it and cope if you're trying to dig, get down in the dirt with these kind of people. So for me, there's no, I have to kill the email, turn the page, and forget about it. I'm not going to keep them in a special folder and look at them and nurture my pain or something like that. No, that's not healthy for me.
What about on social media? Do you engage?
No, on Twitter. Well, I mean, occasionally if somebody tweets something very innocuous and, wanting more information, but I don't even engage with most of the, harmless tweets on Twitter, but I certainly nothing abusive. One of my colleagues showed me one this week. She had retweeted another article with this really innocuous comment, but it was an article about CEO page about the lack of women CEOs, and somebody immediately tweeted back to her, "Shut your bitch mouth, bitch ass mouth." And it was like, "What? She's a business reporter. Like, where are you people reading the Globe and Mail? Like, you're all over the Globe, and this is what you're." And they're just really unhealthy people.
Misha, where do you come to this? Do you engage
with
people?
I think these are both very newspaper-centric points of view. I think that if you're a young person on the internet, and you're on Twitter, like that's part of your personal brand. Like at a certain point, you do have to engage. And there are some people that are really excellent at it. Like Desmond Cole is a great example. He's great at like shutting down his trolls and using them to sort of fuel the conversation. So I think that, where I personally stand, I sometimes, it varies. Sometimes I'll just be in a really snarky mood and I'll have a great comeback and then I'll like burn someone because, it just feels good. If it's like overwhelming, then I'll usually ignore that. But it, sometimes it depends. And being perfectly honest, sometimes reading those comments or getting those emails or whatever, I get ideas for other stories, especially considering that I write about things like racism and sexism. And so just seeing that white male fragility right in front of me, I'm like, okay, great. I'm going to use that in my next call. Thank you.
It's motivating, isn't it?
It's motivating.
Way, it is motivating. Some of it is motivating, I find. Like, it's like, that bothered you? Fine, I'll write more.
Okay.
Yes, totally. Yes, very much so.
What about this argument? That if we don't engage, we don't educate, that, in the last months. You know, we, the media, have been criticized for living in echo chambers and only listening to what we want to hear and people who agree with our points of views, and therefore, and then only writing about that kind of stuff. Where does that argument, does that hold up for you?
Not at all. When you write, you engage. The idea that you have to have a personal conversation with every reader out there is quite absurd. You don't expect actors to show up at movie showings and take questions from the audience. They do it if they're publicizing a movie. But no, I have no obligation whatsoever. That said, I'm Canadian. When people send me nice emails, I read each one and I thank them with their name there, and I acknowledge their kindness. I can't help doing that. But one thing I do is take off my reading glasses as I'm going through my email each morning, and you can tell sort of vaguely, like the C word will stand out. Delete, delete, block, block, block. And that's really good.
Or you can read
wearing sunglasses. That also helps. It's just a physical way of actually protecting yourself as you do. I call it rinse and scrub. Every morning I do that, rinse and scrub, rinse and scrub.
You should have your own show.
Oh, God.
Someone says, you know, we got to let people, they're allowed to have their opinions, free speech, blah, 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 stop being politically correct.
Oh, I hate that.
I think that we definitely are living in echo chambers, and I sometimes feel like I'm writing into an echo chamber. And if you look at Donald Trump getting elected, that kind of is proof of that, because like there were so many bombastic New York Times investigations, and I'm thinking, oh, everyone's going to see this and not vote for him. And it's like, they still voted for him because they're reading like Breitbart or whatever, right? So I do think that that's a real issue, and I've actually contemplated even doing an interview with one of my trolls. But just actually having a conversation with one of them. And I wouldn't choose someone who's like called me the N-bomb or something like that. But one of the more like reasonable trolls.
But how do you decide?
Well, I had one in mind, and he tweets at me every story that I publish. And then when I reached out to him to actually say like, do you want to have a conversation about this? He just immediately backed off. So I think, like, and I'm gonna still keep trying to find one that will do it. I think that a lot of it is they kind of forget that you're actually a person as well, so they're just like attacking the shit out of you. But I think if you actually talk to them, I think generally they would probably soften a bit, or perhaps you both would. I just think it's an interesting dynamic that I personally would like to explore.
Janet, what do you say when people say we have to engage with people that don't share our views on certain issues?
I'm in Heather's camp. I'm more in Heather's camp, as I've already said. I'm very interested in reading media reports, reading articles, even following people. I spend a lot of time, like, you know, I'll read what other people put on Facebook or Twitter, but I won't follow them, or I will, you know, and but I don't think that personally it's just healthy for me to take the next step and become the person in the world who's designated herself as the person to try to change these people's viewpoints. And in many cases, they're not just an opinion, they're an entire mindset, they're an entire,
yes.
These people's personalities are deeply rooted. I mean, I don't think I have the ability to change many of their, many of them. And you know, it's not like one opinion that I just need to, two more facts and I could change his opinion. I don't see it that way.
I feel a little bit like I'm kind of in between the perspectives here, in the sense that I want to talk to everyone and yell at them and tell them that they're wrong. And I kind of glom onto the idea that if I kill them with kindness, they will come around. In other words, if I engage with them, maybe they're, as Manisha says, just someone who you could convince them. You could say, you know, that's really hurtful.
Does it work? Has it worked for you?
It's worked sometimes. It hasn't worked sometimes, right? And then then I also sometimes feel, well, if I stay silent, then isn't that putting the burden on other female journalists who decide to engage, to push us collectively forward? And I feel it's mostly young women journalists who tend to engage social media-wise on these issues. And I'm like, what's my role to play in this? Am I kind of just standing to the side and say it's too hard for me, or I'm not going to engage, but then the burden is kind of placed on you. Do you feel that as a young journalist, that we older journalists kind of step to the side and leave you there for the fight?
I mean, definitely the vibe that I'm getting from these two ladies on stage with me is that they're like more likely to want to not want to engage. But I don't. That's such a personal decision. Like, I can't be the one making that decision. I wouldn't expect everybody to want to engage with a troll. I have like a morbid curiosity about it, which is kind of what's mostly driving it. But yeah, like if you think it's going to be bad for your mental health and you're not going to be able to do your job or anything, like people have reasons for making those decisions. So I wouldn't feel good about saying that other, you know, just because you're older or whatever, you should step in and weigh in on this if you don't want to.
I also think there's a female imperative to be kind to guys who are mean. And that's why we don't often know how to react when we're groped, say. And I've been groped in the newsroom. That's happened to me. All kinds of things have happened to me in the newsroom. And I don't know how to react because it has been absolutely drilled in me since I was a child, be nice. So you're confused and you don't know what to do. And did you see the film of Steve Bannon and Reince Priebus, and Steve Bannon put his hand on Reince's thigh? Okay, which has happened to me in a newsroom. And Reince Priebus immediately went, get away. Get away. I just brushed him off and I was going, Reince, you have taught me a valuable lesson in life. This is how you should react. Not being helpful and not thinking about that person's feelings and trying to change their mind. Just get your hands off me. I thought that was great. So maybe we should be tougher and say, go away in some form. I know I'm not allowed to swear at readers, but you know, get stuffed is something I often say. Am I allowed to say that, Kathy? Can I say get stuffed?
I think you just did.
Okay. Yes. Like three times.
Yes. Yeah. And we've got about 10, 15 minutes left. I want to talk about, and we had a phone call last week, and I can't remember which one of you raised this, but talked about like, hey, what is your news organization doing? What's your organization doing? And Manisha, you brought up this idea that they take you out for lunch. So let's talk about what our organizations are doing to support us in these things. So is the lunch thing like...
No, that's not like a workplace policy.
Right, that's not
like
an official thing that they do advice.
My editor being a human being right. And being like, do you want to go for lunch?
That's right. So nice.
You've had a shitty time with this. But which I have to say is more than I've seen done in a lot of newsrooms, even just that, like being a normal human and checking in on somebody, you don't see that, you know, from a lot of editors in certain places. But workplace-wise, you know, we've now been told to sort of screenshot any abuse that we see directed our way and to report it right away to our editors, and sort of a case-by-case basis. Like we have lawyers that work for us, so if there's something that they can intervene on, I assume that, you know, they'll look at the options. But we have been told now, like, take the screenshots and at least report it to an editor. And then
what happens?
I don't know. Like, really. I think it's just evaluated, but I think they want to at least know about it, and they want us to tell them, you know, what's happening. And then we also have a new employee assistant program, which is like, it's basically a phone line that you can call, and it offers things like counseling and stuff like that, and it can sort of help direct you to certain services. So
the onus is on you.
That's a brand new thing, yeah.
Is that Morneau Chappell that you're supposed to call? That's a company that...
It's a company, yeah, I don't remember the name.
It's so funny, because Bill Morneau, the finance minister, owns Morneau Chappell, and I always feel funny calling the finance minister to tell him all my personal problems. It's so weird.
Janet, what's happening at the Globe?
I think the Globe is a large enough company. There's a lot of HR policies about abuse internally, but I think it would be really helpful. I don't think there's any... I'm not aware of any policy about external abuse or social media type abuse. I think it would be extremely helpful for a news organization to articulate that, just so that if people were dealing with a situation, sort of like Manisha said, where like she didn't even say anything initially about, you know, whispered phone call. If it were articulated, at least people who were going through the worst sort of abuse would be aware of what to do about it. I mean, I think there's a lot of people who would just think it's their problem, or you know, wouldn't even realize there was a process. So I think that the Globe should have a policy, and I think it should say, if you feel uncomfortable, tell an editor, tell this designated person, keep copies of the, you know, the tweets or whatever, just to give people a bit of a sense of what to do. And then I don't know what necessarily the Globe should do as the next step, like what it should do about it. I think that obviously in cases that are, you know, criminal level harassment, that's a lot easier to decide what to deal with. And we'll call the police because you've been receiving death threats. When somebody's just calling you an effing moron, on Twitter, what should the organization do about it? I don't entirely know, but at least if there was a process that people knew what to do, at least there would be somewhere for them to start.
One of the advantages of that would be if something did happen to you, the police at least have a start on a list of people who might have done that to you. I think it would be really helpful. It's one of the things I'm going to be suggesting at the Star. I suggested it several years ago, but nothing happened, that when you get really bad things, they should keep it on file, and then the cops have something to look at
as you prepare your funeral.
No, but I mean, it's actually a good point that I mean, I don't keep any of this. I don't keep these. I suppose somebody could search some computer server somewhere for emails. I don't know, but I don't keep really rude emails. Because I think they're negative and unpleasant, and I don't want them.
I know, and you have them on your phone all the time, and that's a horrible feeling.
But I mean, if somebody, now that you've said that, what if this person were to later escalate, but I haven't kept any of the earlier stuff? Maybe, you know, a policy might help people understand that as an
idea. Here's the trouble, or the challenge, which is when it gets to the level where it's obvious, there are policies and things, and there's police and all these things, but a lot of what women are dealing with, I don't want to put it on a hierarchy, but isn't that bad, right? Like, it isn't criminal. It's more than a nuisance and annoyance, and it's taking a toll on us. So it's that murky middle ground that I think organizations, which most is what most of us experience, it's easy or it should be easy when things cross a definitive line. And I think most of our organizations say, we have policies in place. We've got EAPs and we've got HR policies. But they kind of have to hit a bar for those things to kick in. And so what does the Star do, anything below that bar? Like, what do you guys have?
Nothing. But you have interestingly, EAP? Interestingly, we have a new, we all get $5,000 allowance for therapy. That wasn't caused by trolls or anything like that. It was caused by something that happened in the newsroom. But we now have a mental health allowance that we can spend on therapists. So that is one thing.
So when we had this conversation on the phone, one of you asked, well, what does the CBC do? And I said, I don't know, which I can take some responsibility for, that I should probably find out. But I would argue that also probably these things aren't talked about and disseminated enough for all of us to be aware of them. I did some asking just in case anyone is interested. This probably comes from a recent experience that we had in our company, that a lot of these things were put into place, which I will just say is a good thing to come out of a really bad thing. So we have the AP, we have the HR. This is the one, you know, I was like, well, what do we have that's tangible? You know, like, what am I supposed to do, right? They're doing new language and new journalist standards and practices, which will be helpful. It will be guidelines. But I said, like, what do we do? What are we doing? I found this interesting. So we had a number of female reporters when the FHRITP, because I can't say that first word, in the thing happened, when people used to, you know, photobomb reporters and do that thing. And I'm just reading this, and so that happened to a number of our female colleagues, mostly on-air people, and they got together with some managers and to look for solutions. This is interesting because this is from one of the managers, and he wrote, it was a frustrating process because it became clear there was no sure way to stop this from happening. So this is where we're all sort of left struggling, is how do we do this? We do now, especially at sporting events, when we send women journalists out, send them out with security. One of our reporters was grabbed by someone on television last year during the Grey Cup. It's on camera. She has decided to prosecute and is getting support from the CBC in terms of going to police interviews. So just by nature of disclosure, this is what I've been told. So I guess we're making some progress. But if someone said to you, what are we supposed to do tomorrow? How do we make this better? tomorrow?
I think there's no perfect answer, as you said this earlier would have been done, but I think we should not underestimate the value of peer support in this. It's not going to make it better in the sense of making the abusers go away, but it's your peers and your friends at work who really make your entire work career in so many ways, and this is yet another one of them. If you can, depending on the circumstance, if you can like mock somebody with one of your friends and, call him a moron and mock the fact he couldn't even spell stupid right or something, it lightens the whole mood. But of course you can't do that in, cases of serious threats or something like that. But that for me personally is the only way that you can really cope with a situation short of driving to each person's house and changing their entire personality.
Manisha, tomorrow they come to say, Manisha, you've dealt with a lot of this. What can we do better?
I would echo what Janet just said about being able to moan and bitch to your friends and your editors helps. Like just having that support and knowing that somebody cares and thinks it's a big deal is really helpful. I haven't made much use of blocking people off of Twitter or muting people. But I did, they had this one guy who just like was just like a recurring nightmare in my mentions, and I finally muted him, and I actually found like it did make me feel better. Like it was just like this annoying fly around my head that I just swatted. So I would encourage people to sort of figure out what they can do on that end and maybe give it a try. I've talked to women, female reporters who, maybe they're hijabi reporters, and the only people that can follow them on Twitter are people that they actually know. So I would just say, like, if those are certain tangible things where if you feel like it's gotten bad enough, maybe that's a step that you can take. I'm not really at that place yet where I would do that myself, but it is good to know that option is out there.
What if you said, to your editors, it's getting to be a lot for me taking all of this on. I want to recuse myself from doing these kinds of stories for the next little while. How do you think that would land?
I would never do that. I'm not giving up my beat to some like white guy. That would not happen. That just wouldn't happen. I get annoyed. Like when a white guy writes about racism, he'll get comments that are like criticizing his journalism ethics or the story itself. And I'm just like, I would love to have that criticism for once, like attack me on the story itself. Yes. But I certainly wouldn't give away a beat that I carved and worked really hard for.
I asked that, and Heather, I'd like to get your thoughts because Janet said, informal sort of support, which is helpful and wonderful. And you suggested we maybe want to block, but these are like individual things we can do. And what I want to try and get at a little bit is what can our newsrooms do?
A central place to send the most offensive things. They also should consider hardship pay.
Hardship for being a woman?
If you're a female columnist, you have it worse than anyone else. If you're non-white, certainly female and non-white, you have it worse than anyone else. You know what I wish? An editor would take me out to lunch and say,
come to Vice, Heather.
This is what I always say to my husband who gives me advice. I say, I just want it there. And if editors would do that, just show some humanity, then we could all laugh.
Really, that's what you want, there, Heather?
Yes, that's all I want. And, Michael, don't tell Michael I asked that. My editor, Michael Cook, just forget it. There. You're not going to get it there. You're going to get a ham sandwich. That's silly. I'm wanting things that are not going to happen.
But it's so, and I don't want to pick on your editors or anything, but your ask is pretty simple. Just listen to me. Yeah. Like, it's a pretty simple ask.
Basic humanity.
I mean, I would like newsrooms to change in that I don't think they should be from World War II anymore. I think they should update, and they should become more humane. You get better work out of happy people.
Does it help, like, if your friends in the newsroom say they're essentially,
yes,
like, he's an idiot.
It's great.
Because for me, I don't know that I necessarily, I mean, it would be kind of nice to have an editor take me to lunch, but... But I don't really need that. Like, I don't think that would necessarily help me feel a ton better, unless I was going through something really terrible. Well, and you guys have described some pretty terrible stuff. That I think under those circumstances, that probably would help. But as a general rule of thumb, I think it's, you know, if to the extent that they're there helps, it helps me fine to just have it from my friends, say he's an idiot and what a moron. I'm not sure I need
But I think
that
it's the same thing to be recognized, right? And I think, like in broadcasting, especially if you're on the, you know, forward-facing side of things, it's wonderful when producers say to you, I'm sorry that happened to you, or I'm sorry that jerk said that to you, or they're there. It feels good. It makes me feel less alone, right? Because I'm not going to say, I might, but I'd be doing it in sort of a offhanded way, this jerk wrote this thing. But if someone just said to me, God, that must suck, it does, for me, it does something, right? It's just like, I don't fully understand it, but I get it and I recognize it.
Well, it's just validation. Like, the job is so thankless as it is, right? Any reporter will tell you that no matter what they're covering, it often just feels completely thankless. So at least that's like a recognition, a validation of what you're doing. And they're saying like, great work. And I see you. I see that, you know, you're going through this. And so it's nice to get it, even if it's just from your editor. Also, it costs the company nothing, so.
I would take a coffee. They could take a coffee in the kitchen, just off the newsroom. I would be very happy with that.
Can you hear from the star? Can you buy Heather a coffee tomorrow?
We ask for so little.
Do you want to say anything in closing before we open to questions?
No.
Any of you? No? Okay, we'll get into it. There is a mic. Can someone help people with the mic if they need it passed along or? Kind of expose yourself to the center of the room, around the mic.
Now, this is a relaxing part of the evening, and I always answer honestly, so have at it. Let's have some fun here.
And make, you know, it doesn't have to be formed in the form of a question. It's not Jeopardy. I mean, just if you have a comment or an experience.
And if you would, if you feel okay with it, just telling us your name and who you work for, but you don't have to if you don't want to do that. You can be anonymous.
I'm a producer at CBC, so I actually just want to add a little information to what you've got. So I worked on a joint management union committee to deal with the fact that I have this phone number in the local Toronto newsroom. You probably remember it, PF 5808, and basically
it's
anybody
our security
can call
code
that
for
number.
Everything in our house.
Yeah, is that right? Now I know. So what we did is because we were getting these, we would get every crazy would phone us and. We're trying to figure out a way, because I would have, and interns often would answer that phone, and like, they're the craziest people. And I was like, I'd actually worked on a suicide hotline in university, and I had some inkling how to deal with people that are kind of like nonsensical and start screaming at you. And I suddenly realized, like, how can these people deal with this? So anyways, we came up with basically, it's like a laminated sheet, or you could, and it's like what to do with a threatening phone call. And it's just like step one. Step two, call security. If you feel unsafe at any time, here's the number. And now obviously you haven't got one yet, Pia, so we're trying to get, they're in the newsrooms now and they should be spread to everyone. And especially I do think hosts, they are, you know, people figure out how to find you and they can phone you directly and it's alarming. But I will say, like you call the security at the CBC and say, take, you know, put this, I have to notify my manager. It has happened a few times. This person's sent me emails, put them on the list, and there's a guy, Joe Hill, like, you know, there's people, like, stuff's in place. So I think the Globe should probably be a little more. You should know who you call right away.
Are you suggesting the Globe's a little behind modern social trends? Just not quite cutting edge.
So if you can work together with the managers. And the other thing I would say is people, like... You know, I've been in meetings. I had a meeting this week with, again, a joint management one, and I was talking about a reporter who was a male who was really upset because when he went to cover the protests outside the American consulate about refugees, some guy, he was just tweeting, 30,000 people here, and just basic stuff about what was going on, and someone said, I want to drive a truck through. I'd like to drive a truck through them. And he was, like, so upset. Like, I didn't know about this till after because, honestly, I probably would have talked to we should have considered calling the police, but he told me after it was such a hard day, and I'm like, why? And anyways, this manager said, oh, well, you know, you just don't have to tweet. And I thought, and that's true. But then I thought, you know what, like, that's also not the solution here. Like, managers need to say, you know what, he didn't say, oh, that's too bad that happened to him, I feel badly. I think we need to hold you know, the old news guys to account and say, you know what, this is a serious issue. This is not around when you guys were around. People, it's really hard on people emotionally. Like, if you've never been through it, if you've been in management for 20 years, you don't know what it's like to be on the receiving end of this stuff. And it can really bug you, and doesn't, you don't just have to be a woman. So I think we really have to say, hey, we can't poo-poo this. If we can try and get, like, make them realize, hey, and if you, through these processes I've been with managers, if you gotta just keep reminding them, it's not okay to just say, well, just don't tweet. Like, it's something that's a reality. It's gotta be factored in now into your reality of your newsroom. And the more we can just remind people of that, I think is a good thing. So, yeah. So keep the fight up.
Hello, my name is Nicole. I work at a charity in Toronto. My question is, and I feel like you've touched on this a little bit, but I'd like, I don't know if I need specifics, but maybe to talk about it a little bit more, about how this kind of harassment limits your career. So maybe, I know, Manisha, you said you wouldn't change what you're doing because of this harassment, but there might be other journalists who do, or maybe the other two panelists in your careers, you haven't taken a job because you're worried about harassment. So I don't know if you can touch on that a little bit more. Thank you.
I would say you can see it in politics. Like, when you see, like, we're seeing a lot more female politicians coming forward and saying that they've been harassed and bullied online, and even in some cases, like, stepping down from those positions. And I'm sure that it happens probably in journalism as well. Like, we've seen you know, female journalists who have huge Twitter followings, and that's such an integral part of their brand, go off of Twitter, and it's because of, like, this bullying and harassment, and that has to be hugely detrimental to their careers and their brands in a certain way. And also, it just kind of sucks. Like, that shouldn't be the only option that they have. So yeah, I would say, like, just because I said that, I mean, I totally understand why people, you know, would want to take a step back. And I also think we hear a lot from the sort of the far right about free speech in the context of, like, I want to make these racist, sexist remarks and be free to do that. But on the flip side, sort of not having a way to curb this hate speech and bullying, it infringes the free speech of other people, like people who are being victimized and bullied online. Like, they don't feel as confident going out and talking about these issues because they're being bullied to that extent.
Do you have anything else?
Can I say one thing? I just meant to mention this. Maybe I shouldn't mention it, but the reason there's security here tonight is because he's the guy I'm worried about. I'm scared of him, and he knows where I live. He makes it clear he knows where I live. But the sad thing about that is this is an old story for me. When I was at the Sunday Sun, there was a man who emailed me horrible things for 11 years. He even followed me from newspaper to newspaper. I've been, for 5 years, I was phone stalked by someone at the Globe. And the Globe was I called the Globe, and they
somebody
were just,
within the Globe?
Yes. And the Globe was wonderful. They were so kind. They handled it brilliantly. Their HR person was wonderful. Nice. So it happens everywhere you go. And the problem is not the things that are said to you. Your real problem is obsession. When people become obsessive, and that's really scary. And that, I think, is truly terrifying for women.
Hi, my name is Kat Shermack. I'm a freelance journalist. So I really value these conversations that we have as women. I think they're really important. You guys all spoke about having female friendships and how important that can be. And I really get a lot out of this kind of these panels and conversations. However, having said that, I'm really, really sick and tired of women always having to be the ones. What do we have to do better? When the reality is, the vast majority of this abuse comes from men, not women. So I was wondering if you guys could speak to that a little bit, and just, why aren't men having these conversations? Why aren't they looking at themselves and being like, yeah, we suck?
No, you're right. I mean, it really sucks. I guess the reason that I haven't said, you know, is I don't know how to go out and change the large minority of marginal men who are abusive and angry and broken inside, and it's sad that they exist, but You know, as an individual journalist, I don't have the ability to find those people and fix them. And maybe as a society, maybe journalism more broadly, I have no idea what the solutions are. But all you can do, all I can do is take care of myself in that narrow way. I mean, that comment probably is going to sound bad out of context. But, do you have any ideas? Like, how do you put this on the men and make it their problem?
So this isn't specific to media, but I remember growing up, my mom would always, I have a brother, and she would always say, like, when I'm going out, like, oh, make sure no one puts a roofie in your drink. Like, she would always say that to me. But she never said to my brother, like, don't put a roofie in someone's drink. So I, again, this isn't specific to me. Like, I think in media, we do face a lot more, just because we have to be very visible people. But yeah, I think it's, maybe there's
yeah,
something
we don't
to do.
We don't tell our sons, don't get drunk and go rape a woman. Mm-hmm. But we tell our daughters, don't drink too much so you make sure you don't get raped, right? It's a bit talking to people. And I think part of the challenge for us is we don't like talking about ourselves because we're always told in the media, you're navel gazing. And so we don't talk about ourselves because we're never the story, except that we're part of every story. And I think that's a challenge for us. I would say, you know, there's responsibility on everyone's side. And I don't sit around with my guy colleagues and talk about this stuff. Probably don't even do it with my women colleagues, but I'd probably bring it up with a bunch of women colleagues more than I would with guys. That's not like in my headspace, isn't something I deliberately do, but it would just seem more natural to do that with my women colleagues, friends.
I think it's interesting that there's clearly more women here than men, I think. But it's sort of like we're having these conversations, really it's men who need to hear what we're saying more than women. So I think, like, you know, in the future it would be nice if there were more men or more men in management sort of showing up to these events and hearing that. And one positive thing I will say is yesterday I was on assignment with Julie Lalonde, who's like a sex violence activist, and she was speaking at a high school, she was speaking to like teenage boys, and it was all these jarring statistics about sexual assault and about not being violent to women, and the crowd largely seemed to really respond really well to it. And so I think at a more grassroots level, like, we need to see more of that just going, taking on the really young generation, like at school level, and teaching them how to be good people and how to not be violent towards women.
We've seen some of the reports about women who've been horribly harassed off of social media, and there was a famous one, an American journalist who, long story short, it was all traced back to a teenage boy who people were shocked that this ordinary seeming kid was spewing this hate and actually really harming people's lives. And maybe we are too complacent, thinking, well, I've never told my son not to verbally harass women with social media, but damn it, maybe we all should. Or maybe as a society, we should be promoting that as a campaign or advertising the idea that maybe you literally need to specifically tell people this is inappropriate behavior so they understand it's inappropriate and they don't mistakenly think it's some sort of weird laugh or joke or kind of fun to see how much they can scare somebody or something.
Hi, my name is Kate Hopwood. I work at The Globe in ROB with Janet. And I'm just really interested in everyone's take. We've kind of touched on this in a few different ways tonight, but there's been this growing wave of female politicians who have recently been speaking out about the level of harassment they're receiving. And I within my own personal group of friends, none of this is particularly surprising, perhaps, but I've spoken with my father about it, and he was shocked because this was brand new information to him.
Jane, do you want to talk about that? Because you were talking so well about that before. Jane covered politics for 25 years at the Globe and Mail, and she was, before we started today, she had so many great thoughts and about women politicians facing way worse abuse.
I guess my question is, to what degree does the act of covering these types of stories and the fact that we're bringing stories of this harassment to a wider audience who may in fact realize the scope of the problem in a way that's new to them, like, how do these two worlds of us grappling with the issue ourselves as female journalists and trying to cover an issue that in many ways may cut very deeply, like, there's, I don't know if there's tension there or not. I just think it's kind of an interesting.
But it's a good idea to cover it more, right? So that people like your dad who are shocked actually realize. I think your point is really great. I mean, and about politics as much as maybe there should be stories written about the kind of abuse that women in the media also get as well. But
yeah, I mean, I think that I personally, like I believe guys have probably noticed that I have a tendency to sort of downplay these things, and so I assume that people won't be shocked. But when I do tell people, even like my best friends, you know, when I send them some of the, like I've gotten like Nazi memes that say like, It's like Nazi Germany, what happens when you push the white kids too far? Like I've had stuff like that in my inbox and people are actually shocked by that. I think that it is important to share these stories. I think maybe as women or as especially women in the public eye, you normalize it yourself. And so I think we do need to keep kind of like hitting people over the head with it again and again and, until they sort of get it or until change happens. You know, the same way that we talk, you know, we're talking a lot more about racism and about sexual violence, and these aren't new issues at all in any way. But, you know, it's important to sort of keep on it because it's still pretty surprising to a lot of people, especially people who, you know, are privileged enough not to experience it themselves.
I find that younger male colleagues are absolutely wonderful and very understanding of this. And that's because they live in the digital world. They're completely used to that. Whereas maybe older guys who remember when they think threats, all the kind you send with pen and paper and a stamp, they think it's that when it doesn't resemble that at all. But the younger male colleagues, they understand it completely. And they're really comforting.
Well, thank you. I work at TVO. I used to work with that lovely lady up there. Some years ago, before we used to moderate our comments online, we used to get some pretty awful remarks. They weren't necessarily directed at the women, but they were just, you know, heinous people. And in some cases, these people would use their names and where they came from and who they were. Like, you just had to Google their name and see, oh, a very respected realtor from so-and-so. Yeah. And we often used to wonder, what would happen if we told their employer this is what they're posting online? And I think, like, I mean, one of the reasons why, I mean, you don't know how unhinged the person is, so you just don't want to, I mean, I don't engage at all, but also, you know, ratcheting it up to that level might, you know, bring out an unhinged person. But it's just amazing, I found, what people would do and how they would identify themselves.
I had an email one time from a guy who used his company email with his company signature on it. Like there was no hiding. And it was this really abusive, like, you're a stupid moron kind of an email. And I looked at it for a while, and then I thought, you know, I've never done this before, but I forwarded it to the company's media relations person, and I said, does the company have a concern with something I've been writing about, or was this just his own personal? It was really disingenuous because I knew it was obviously just his own personal thing, right?
That's a good one.
But I'm a business reporter, and I thought, okay, let's just see what happens. So I got back a very snappish little email from this person saying, that is not our position, period. Like, it was so not like, oh my God, I'm so horribly embarrassed. It was just like, that's not our position. So, like, how dare you pretend that. And I never did it again, but now that you're talking.
I've done it, and it worked. Yeah. The company has been horrified that anyone would say such a thing. Oh, yeah. And it all depends on how you phrase your complaint. If you do it like a nice lady who's been, her feelings are hurt because she really loves Manitoba. So how dare you, you know? And yeah, you get a lovely email back from the boss, and you figure it's going to be dealt with.
I just wonder if that's a tactic that we can use back again.
It's a great idea. Expose more of these people if you can.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Shelley. I'm a freelance journalist. So, I come from a different background, so I'm sort of starting off early stages in a career in journalism. And so just, I guess my question is, I guess for those that are starting off, is the future bleak? I mean, I'm a bit shocked from what I'm hearing, to be honest, because I mean, I'd known about this, and it happens in every industry, but I'm a bit like, oh my God. Like,
have you experienced it yourself? Yeah.
No, not at all. And so that's why I'm a bit like, wow, is this what my future is going to be?
You know what? If I didn't write anything about women, if that wasn't part of my beat and what I write about, I would be sitting here going, oh, I don't know, I haven't had any trouble. It depends what you, I think it depends a bit on what you want to do as a journalist and what you want to write about.
Right, right. So you're saying it won't necessarily happen.
Well, I mean, it won't happen, I'm not promising at all, but I'm saying there are certain, columnists are way more vulnerable, and people who are writing about controversial issues like race and gender are more vulnerable. It depends what you know. I'm not saying that nobody will get mad at you about the City Hall reporting that you've done or something, but I think that there are more vulnerable positions than others.
You're new in the business. Sally, you've been writing about women's issues for a gajillion years. Do you get this stuff? Can I, just so we can get like kind of where we are compared to where we've been?
You know, I think there's some idea that the internet invented this. When I worked at a magazine, let me tell you what these trolls did then. All you need to do was look in the food section of the magazine to write your letter. And it could get terribly sexual. They would send you a letter that cut words right out of the magazine saying, cut breast in half, remove skin, slather with lard. I mean, this has been going on forever. And in those days, we would send it to the police. But there weren't as many of them, and there weren't as many of us. So my question to you is, why don't you do something about it? This idea, where's the person who said, they got the name of the company, and Janet, you did that. Why don't we do something about this? How come they own the podium? I mean, shouldn't we be taking action? Shouldn't we be getting, maybe we have a policy at a paper that says you have to include your full name or more information. They are putting pressures on you. Look what Heather's going through right now. And we seem to be reacting in terms of how to have a sandwich with a boss or a friend to protect us. I think it's time we created policy.
But what do we do? What do we do, Sally?
Because it's
so
easy.
Well, the last idea about, or your idea about sending it to somebody.
Well, that's a rare case where somebody
used
his own
name. Why don't we do a story about this? Why don't we publish some of them that might even attract more of them? But my feeling is we're being too passive. We should, surely together we can come up with an idea for how to stop it, because it goes on.
Do you still get it now in the internet age?
I still get it now. Yes, at my age.
I didn't say your age. I said you've been doing this. But do you still, like, when you go write about women's issues nowadays, you get internet hate. And why are you writing about this stuff, and aren't you a terrible human being?
Yes. Yeah. And the threats, and it goes on. Because we haven't found a way to stop it, but I think there is a way if we decide to go after it.
And so to the woman's question, who said, I'm just starting out, is the future bleak? Do I just have to, like, if I'm going to do this, deal with this, you would say?
Well, I think it is the best job. We know that. And getting these stories is what keeps all of us going. But there is a danger level to this. And some of this, all of you have been at an edge that you wonder, is he waiting outside? Or does he know where I live? Anyway, I think you should take action.
I think you're right.
Hi, I'm Carla. I work at TVO. Back when I was freelancing, this isn't my question, but I just want to say, for two elections, I took a freelance contract working at ctv.ca as a comment moderator. And I'll tell you, it was the most depressing two stints of 6 weeks in a row I've ever done in my life. Depressing, maddening, terrifying. And I did it for 8 hours from my couch for six straight weeks, 5 days a week. It was really tough. You know, I willingly took that as a freelance gig because it paid well, but I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. No. My question again is about the female politicians who, in my mind, I think that something's really changed, because they're not putting up with this stuff anymore. They're getting up on legislature floors and reading the tweets, reading the comments, talking about what their male colleagues are saying to them. And I'm wondering if anyone has any idea about what's changed, why they're doing that now. Where are they getting the courage to do that?
Where the female politicians are getting the courage?
I mean, I don't think it's changing anything, but they are actually speaking out, and they're speaking out very publicly. So I'm wondering if anyone on the panel can sort of track back to where the change was that maybe gave them more courage. Was it the "We Believe Her" hashtag that was going around a couple of years ago? Or
I'm not sure how many, depending on the age of the female politician, I'm not sure how much they would be impacted by a campaign like that. I don't know.
I mean, I think that the Gomeshi trial impacted a lot of people, and that's where that came from, We Believe Her.
I'll tell you what I worry about with this particular story is it's novel right now, if I can put it that way. And when we see female politicians stand up in the House and talk about it, I mean, I do think it resonates with a lot of us. Even though we're not dumb, we know it happens, it resonates. But I think there will soon come a day where when people start saying this more and more, someone in some newsroom is going to say, "What's new about this?" And that's when we stop covering this, right? What's new? We know it's a problem. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of where we've gotten to with all these issues. As Manisha was saying, none of these issues are new. Sally said it's been going on for time.
But
our problem as journalists is to make sure that what's new doesn't always have to be the bar for a story.
Right. And so any idea how we can do that?
Well, I think we make journalistic arguments about why we need to tell these stories. I mean, for me, my fight is, yes, in the public, but my fight on these issues are more with internal, with the organization and with my senior producer and my executive producer and their boss who sit around a table. Sometimes I'm there, sometimes I'm not, and say, you know, in kinder terms than this, but been there, done that. What's new to say? And I think that's sort of collectively where we as journalists need to say, yeah, you know, we've been telling the same six stories since the beginning of time. And yet when Janet has to do, I don't know, some Securities Commission report for the 9,000th time in her career, I bet you rarely get, been there, done this before, why should we do it again? But I think with these kinds of more social issues, we have to kind of stand up and say why they're important.
They're seen as soft.
Or there's nothing new. What are we going to learn? We know it's a problem.
That's right.
But I mean, we're seeing it, you know, we're having this panel tonight, and we're seeing it with public figures of all kinds. So to me, it is a story. I don't know how to get over the hump of that's not news. So if anyone has any ideas,
well, you always do have to come up with a fresh angle on it. And that's what we try really, really hard to do. So we have to keep it, you have to keep it interesting and approach it from a different way every time. But you know, the digitization of human life has happened, and it brought people into to allow people to say things who had never been heard from before. Mm-hmm. So this is permanent. This is never going to go away. So we do have to deal with this problem. I don't know how, but I absolutely do not take the dark view of journalism that thing you shouldn't enter journalism. It's just so exciting and interesting. How many people could say their jobs are interesting? My job is really interesting. And it's a job that'll take you many places. It's enjoyable, it's exciting, and I don't want to tell people to take the dark view on this. Get excited by it. Like every other problem that's ever existed, digitization, it solved many problems. It made us not have to go to the library anymore. It made life a lot easier, and in this way, it's made it a lot harder.
It has also brought a lot more support, for me personally, it's brought a lot more support into my life than it has negativity, in the sense that if I write a story about some issue about women, you know, 30 people might write me a Twitter thingy saying something positive about it, and one person might write something really awful. Well, like, let's focus on the fact that the social media also brought me a lot of, to the extent that I needed support and encouragement to continue, it's also brought me that too, so you can kind of choose where to focus.
And I would just say, this is exactly what they want. This is exactly what they want. For you to consider opting out.
Yes.
Because it's too hard. And what they're trying to do, and not with a lot of like group thought, but they're trying to silence us. Right? And that's the tool of journalism, that we won't be silenced. That's what we do. We give voice to each other and to, yes, contrary opinions, but if we all go, you know, and I'm, it's too much, and I know it's a personal decision, but if we all say, we're not going to write about women's issues, whatever the heck that means, human issues, or race and stuff like that, they've won.
Yes, they've exactly. Won. And that's when I feel fierce. I'm not going to let them win. And one reason I haven't written about International Women's Day tomorrow is I see it as something that I write about all year. I talk about women's rights all year, so that was my decision. I will fight back that way.
My name is Nicholas. I'm a former business journalist and now blogger. This is making me angry and upset, and I'm wondering how can we hit back? And instead of not stopping what you do, but hitting back, and what if there was a company, they do it in the nonprofits do, right, groups like Anonymous, they find the people who send the stuff to WikiLeaks, they find ways to track these people down, shut them down. What if there was a company that could, the police won't do it, but imagine a company with a couple guys called Igor who could knock on your, you know, this guy's door who's bugging you and say, hey, we know where you live too. You know, so obviously within the law, but what if we could hit back?
I think that would be, like, I think that would feel really good. Like, I would love one of my trolls to get fired. Just for, like, sort of that satisfying, like, vengeance aspect of it. But I think, what about the larger systemic issue? Like, if we did something like that, is that really getting at this larger issue, which is that men treat women really badly on the internet? Like, that's what I don't know if it would be really getting to that part of it.
And to be fair, women also treat women quite badly on the internet. That is a problem as well.
Hi, my name is Joanna. I'm an educator and consultant, not a journalist. But in listening to your story, I can't help but put the situation into the broader perspective of the types of harassment that women experience and girls experience all over, whether it's in education, fire departments, police services, RCMP, taxis. And on the theme of hitting back, I can't help but think that until there's a price to be paid for this type of action, it's going to continue. And whether that price is a class action lawsuit, an individual lawsuit, some sort of workplace cost, it will likely continue. So I'm very curious about how we can increase the cost for the harassers, because that seems to be the main way to dissuade them when they're doing their own cost-benefit analyses on who and when they're going to harass somebody.
Well, I think, I mean, I'm intrigued by exploring the idea of exposure more. Mm-hmm. My only hesitation is I don't know if I really want to get in, you know, I like the idea of finding these people's real names and, you know, publicizing them or sending something to their company or putting it on Twitter, like replying to them on Twitter, mentioning their real name because I've researched it. But that takes time and energy and effort and an emotional commitment that, you know, everybody here can judge me, but I just don't know that I want to do that.
Yeah, I'd be too lazy to do that, honestly. It'd be so much effort, and it just takes away from your actual job. So, I don't know.
That doesn't mean you have to do
it. Yeah, if someone else was going
to...
Yeah. But even with lawsuits, I mean, how feasible would that be to sue someone who was mean to you online? Like, I just don't think it would be worth the effort, because at the end of the day, they would be able to defend themselves under free speech, most likely. So
this will be our last question, and then Kathy English will come up.
Hi, my name is Brian Smith. I've worked with BMO and was a journalist. But what we're talking about tonight, I think, is not just about journalists. I think that the whole discourse, civil discourse, has frankly become quite different from, I'm an old white guy, from when I was younger. Part of it, I think, is all wrapped up in anonymity.
Yes.
And the Ku Klux Klan used to have the benefit of anonymity by putting a white hood over their heads. The people who wrote to you, Sally, would cut things out of the, and they'd be anonymous when they sent it to you. So as long as we have the anonymity, that's going to be, I think, the real issue. I don't know why we don't require, if they're going to be making comments on your newspaper or sending you things, or even on Twitter. I mean, I think that's out of the barn by now. But if we were able to get people to actually put a face to themselves when they stand up and remove the cloak of anonymity, I think that you'd find that a lot of the things that are said, just nobody would have the guts to stand up and say in public what they think they can do anonymously.
I mean, Vice removed comments from articles, so you can't
really
comment on an article anymore. But
the
majority of our comments anyway come from our Facebook posts, and so it'll be like, you know, whatever, in some cases like hundreds or thousands of comments. And people, I mean, those are their Facebook profiles that they use to post, so a lot of times it is their name and their faces. So I think part of the problem is that people just aren't embarrassed as they should be to hold the disgusting views that they have. They're actually shameless. And I think, especially under Trump, you know, people who are racist and sexist, they've absolutely been emboldened. And they're actually boosted up by these online communities that hold the same views as them.
Yeah. The echo chamber you talk about. No, I agree.
Yeah.
I was just going to make one final comment. I mean, talking about politicians, certainly female politicians have been attracting a lot of attention of late, but I wouldn't want to be any politician today, because you're going to get trolled. The comments won't be perhaps as directed and as sexual and as gender-based as they are when you get attacked, but I'm sure that everybody is feeling a real disincentive to get into politics because they're going to be exposed to the same kind of trolling.
And just in closing, I wonder if one of the solutions might be this. Someone tweets something at me. What if the main CBC account, what if that, which is, I don't know who runs it, but if we had language that they wrote back and said, this is not acceptable to, you know, attack one of our journalists this way, maybe that would scare a few of them off. I don't know, but it's one of the things. If I got that little icon from the Star, said Kathy English's name on it, so I'd probably think twice before I sent the next one to Heather Malik. And I wonder if we did sort of Vanguard like that, that might be one solution. But I really feel like our battle right now is to make this an important issue, a more important issue in many of our organizations. To, you know, we have to educate from within and also out. And I think, you know, our editors, our bosses, we're all like having this busy off of how busy we are, right? And if we don't take the time to say, this is really important, and it's actually contributing to my busyness because it's taking a lot of mental energy. So I would just say in closing, please go talk to your colleagues about this tomorrow. Tell a friend. Tell a boss. You don't say it was great. Just go say, you know, I said this thing last night, made me think about this. Do that. There's 60 people here. We got 60 conversations started tomorrow. Yes. Kathy English, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm Kathy. I am the programming chair of the CJF. I'm also the public editor of the Toronto Star, which I receive my share of harassment. Some might argue that it's part of the job description, but I'm very clear that there have to be limits, and I really agree that we as organizations need to find ways to help our people. I've heard a lot of newsroom editors say to me, oh, just tell them to ignore it, you know, as if not looking at it makes it okay. And we know that it can be soul destroying, and we need to find a way. And there's been lots of great ideas tonight. So on behalf of the CJF, I want to thank our panel for your honesty and your insights. This is a matter of deep concern to women in journalism and all journalists, men too. I'd like to believe that no one in journalism need face this kind of garbage for doing their job, but we know that we do. Thank you, Pia Chattopadhyay, for leading our discussion. We really appreciate you making this a great discussion. And your comment that you're so glad we have each other really resonates, so thank you.
Thank you to these three.
Yes, please join me in a round of applause for our entire panel. Yes. And now I have the pleasure of telling you about our very exciting upcoming events. Do we have Great. Okay. On April 20th, we're going to take a look at the future of news for public broadcasters. We've got a great lineup. Jennifer McGuire, head of CBC News. James Harding, the BBC's director of news and current affairs, is coming over the pond. And Michael Oreskes, NPR's senior vice president of news, will be here as well. The wonderful Simon Haute, the senior media writer for the Globe and Mail, will moderate. So please come. May 24th is going to be a real extravaganza of riches for journalism. Two events being held the same night at Roy Thompson Hall. First up is a panel, The Media as Opposition, covering Trump in a post-truth era. We've got really the superstars of independent journalism on the panel that night. Amy Goodman, Naomi Klein, Glenn Grunwald, Jeremy Scahill, all in a conversation moderated by Hannah Sung of the Globe and Mail. That's going to be followed by a discussion with Matt Taibbi, the journalist and author of Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. What a great conversation that's going to be. He'll be in conversation with David Walmsley, editor-in-chief of the Globe and Mail. So please look for our emails and reminders and join us for our events. And now I'd like to invite you to have a cocktail, meet our panel, and let's keep this conversation going. In this room, outside, on social media, we really do need to support one another. And on this eve of International Women's Day, it's a message to take to heart. Thank you.